Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Third hour, Darren Donica Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Hope everybody's having a great day on this Wednesday. We say hello and good afternoon to Vanderbilt basketball coach Jerry Stackhouse. Coach, how you doing?
Good afternoon, fellas. How you guys?
We're doing fantastic. I'm going to throw you with a curveball right out of the gates, okay?
Uh-oh.
Because I don't no, it's just something about your childhood that we went down this rabbit hole the last 30 minutes on the show and did not realize we were going to get the input that we did from the listeners. But how would you answer this question? Name one thing from your childhood that young people today wouldn't understand. Something from your childhood that probably some kids on your basketball team would just tilt their head and they would say, Coach, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Probably a cassette tape.
Yep.
That's
cassette
right.
Tape and, you know, and using a pen or a pencil to wind it once it, they wouldn't know what to do with
it. Oh, man, that's a
that
skill that you
fantastic.
Have to have. You have to have that skill.
That is exactly what we're looking for. That is something
you know,
that have your
and,
kids
and imagine
going.
It actually breaking and then having to get a little piece of scotch tape to splice it up. That's you really love that tape.
Oh, man,
oh,
did
that,
we all do that or what?
That's a real skill. The person in your neighborhood who could pull that off was talented. That scotch tape to keep
no
the tape
doubt.
Alive when it broke.
Now, this
My
is going to
–
This will test your memory. So what was that cassette tape for you that you probably played so much you wore it out that you had to tape it over and over a couple of times just to keep listening to it? What would that group
new
be?
Edition.
New edition.
Yeah.
That
great.
Is great.
Cool it now.
Yeah. Mr. Telephone Man was on that tape,
oh,
I think.
Oh, man, you already know it. That was the jam.
That is fantastic.
I had that tape. I definitely had that tape.
No doubt. I definitely had that tape. So how's life been under these, you know, unusual times for you?
Man, it's been interesting, really, man. I mean, obviously been able to spend a lot of time with family and, you know, obviously traveling so much over the last, you know, probably ever, right? Always going somewhere in season or off season, planning on doing something, and now just being able to just stay home with family and drinking a little too much, but I am working out, so it's balancing it out a little bit.
You're right. We have definitely changed some habits for sure. We've talked about on this show, it's, you know, trying to find the positives, trying to find some good things out of doing a four-hour show every day with no live sports, even though finally some things are starting to come around. But we've had some interviews, really, really good interviews, where just feel like people are relaxed and things are slowed down and you're just getting some real genuine interviews where we can talk about you rewinding or taping your new edition cassette tape that, you know, we wouldn't be talking about that with you coming into a season or during a season. So it's allowed us to, you know, get to know people better, hear things that you're never going to talk about under normal circumstances. Have you found that to be true with talking, you know, maybe on the recruiting trail? Is it easier now for these coaches on the recruiting trail and also getting to know your kids better, whether it's via Zoom or, you know, however much you talk to your coaches and your kids these days?
I think that's a great point, man. I think just being able to, you know, with so much we took for granted, right? Just, you know, because we were able to go and move so freely and do so much and even work, you know, we figure out we're still able to get, you know, get work done and, you know, with the Zoom and still able to talk. I mean, going in the office from 9 to 5, I think that's what we figured out. A lot of that is overrated. We
yeah.
still get a lot accomplished without just the having the busy work mentality. I have to be on the clock. And I think, you know, Obviously, we want to get back, and I think the fellowship and camaraderie of being around people and being around staff and everything is cool. But I just think this has showed us that, hey, man, we can we can be by ourselves a little bit more. We can still enjoy each other's company and you know, take advantage of this time. But I mean, like I said, it hadn't been, you know, I'm kind of a homebody anyway, so it hadn't been a big drastic change for me. I do like to go out to eat, so I miss going out to restaurants and things like that. But you know, the golf course is still open. I'm still going out there and hacking it up big time. So you know, it's not all bad.
Yeah, I miss the restaurant scene as well. It's interesting. Some of the we had Dave. You know, some of these candid conversations and relaxed conversations. David Price, you know, told us the story of him walking into Tim Corbin's office and saying, I don't want to do this, his freshman year, and I just want to go flip burgers at McDonald's. I just want to be a normal kid. And just think about how different his life would be if, you know, Tim Corbin didn't have that conversation with then a freshman, David Price. Mookie Betts came on here and told us about, you know, the time when, you know, he just – maybe he was thinking about switching sports. So I get it. You went to North Carolina. You were a high draft pick. But you had to have had a fork in the road at some point in your playing career, right, as an athlete. Where was that moment for you where maybe you questioned or something happened where you were even thinking about switching sports? I don't know how you're going to answer it, but how where would you go with that?
Well, I think it was at North Carolina my freshman year. Again, I just the adversity that you just deal with as a freshman coming in, and everything has kind of been about you, and you've always won and always had success, and you were a large part of it. And I think being in North Carolina going into that freshman season with a team that had just won a national championship, and you know, we were coming in as some brash, you know freshmen that as myself, Rasheed Wallace, and Jeff McInnes. And it was just like, it was tough, man, just a challenge because I obviously felt like you should have been playing more. Even in practice, I felt like I was, you know, handling my business there, but it wasn't translating. I was still only playing probably 18 minutes a game and getting 12 and 13 points in those 18 minutes. So I was just like, man, I don't know if this is the right spot for me. And I was like, you know, it just, I remember one day coming back home from the dorm, and my mom was in the car, and I was just like, I'm just lamenting with to her, you know. She just hears me out the whole way, just like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I could be doing more, this and that, the other. And she heard me out the whole way. And then she just finally, you know, at the end, just like, if you start running now, you're going to be running the rest of your life. And that just was something that stuck with me. And probably less than 10 days later, I'm the most outstanding player of the ACC tournament. So just like, man, you know, a couple of things, just learning how to deal with adversity. But I think one of the key things there is just learning to listen to adults. Like you said, listening to Coach Corbin or listening to your parents. At 18, 17, 18, 19 years old, we don't have it figured out. We think we do. But, you know, having those people that have gone through some things and have seen some things and them telling you that it's okay to go through some things, I think that changed my life. If I go somewhere else, I'm probably not here right now, so I'm just glad that I had, you know, that type of figure to kind of put me in my place.
Wow, what a great line. And it does seem like that fork is around that age group that you said. I feel like all these stories that we've gotten are like the 17, 18, 19-year-old range. So you're still very early on in your coaching career. There's no manual that shows you the longer you do this, you're going to have to face those types of things as a head coach, where a kid's going to come into your office, and question whatever. There's no manual to show you how to handle that. Your mom just gave you a great line and great advice that you've carried with you throughout. How do you think you'll handle those situations? Who are some people other than your mother, and maybe who's a coach that you played for that can help you when you have to face those situations as a head coach, you can give the right advice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still my parents. You know, I think, you know, not so much just them. It's more life issues than just basketball issues. You know, I think, you know, from a basketball standpoint, I can tell you what needs to happen and what's going on because I lived it. But just kind of dealing with, you know, this Generation Z, it's different because they know so much. Again, we didn't. They have access to so much information, And it's just, and not that they, I think there's a lot of people like to say, well, they're softer than we were back then. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case. It's just, again, they have so much more information at their fingertips, you know, through social media, through what, so they know more. So we just have to deal with them a little differently. But I think those same stories I share in our recruiting visits when I talk to kids, like, it's not always going to go right here. You know what I'm saying? If you expect an to go perfect, if you come to Vanderbilt and play for me, then you probably need to go somewhere else. It's not going to happen like that. Life is not like that. And it's, but again, if you work and you're passionate about it and you put, you know, the time and the energy in it, I think those things transcend time. You know what I'm saying? So if you got those principles and you got that type of makeup, things don't really work out for you. And those are the type of guys that we look for and really, you know, press to try to be a part of our, you know, what we're doing and what we're trying to build.
We're talking to Jerry Stackhouse, the head coach of the Vanderbilt Commodore basketball program. And coach, I want to ask you, I'm sure a lot of people have tried to pick your brain with your perspective as we've all watched The Last Dance. And one of the things that dawns on me is you know, you watch an NBA game today, and it's a big story if a team doesn't hit 100 points. But when you first got into the NBA during this era that we were just focusing on with towards the last few years of Michael Jordan's career, you look at the end final score of a lot of those games, great battles that we all watched, and the score might be 83-79. It was just a different played game, the way they sort of let contact go with defenders. You could get away with a lot more. Take us back to that time, especially when you got into the league. It was not easy to score, was it?
No, I mean, I think the game changed. I mean, you had teams like in the 80s with the Denver Nuggets and those guys, I mean, the West Coast teams, they were putting up 130s. Like the game kind of goes in cycles. And for, I think Detroit kind of started it, you know, toward the end of the, you know, that Bad Boys era. And it felt like putting defense in the game and making it tough. I think they were kind of the pioneers of, you know, leading into the 90s when the games were, you know, more about defense and getting stops. Even though you had great offensive players and guys that could put up big, you know, big scoring nights, you were still, like Michael had 35, had 40, and the game was still, you know, 87. So I just think it was a lot less possession. And that was something that was, you know, a point of emphasis from the league and the Board of Governors to have more freedom of movement. And then you have, you know, the Steph Currys and those. I think those guys were game changers because they lived behind the three-point line. It was nothing for him to come, you know, past half court, two or three, you know, steps past half court and let it go. And it's a good shot for him. And then you see James Harden. So I just think the game changes a little bit, but it was definitely different. I mean, I don't know if it was better or worse. You know, I mean, I enjoyed all the eras. I enjoyed the 80s and the 90s and even the game now. But it's definitely different, man. You know, we used to, you know, but the game, you had guys isolated and they had to be above the three-point line so you could play one-on-one and do different things. And that just not the game now. It's more spacing, more timing, more. I wouldn't want to coach me right now. You know, really. I mean, really, just because I wanted to play in the mid-range. I want to play in the mid-post. You know, you're stopping the ball while I do my thing. And now it's more about passing, cutting, and getting space and giving other guys room to work. So it's just a different game. Still a great, beautiful game, but just different.
Well, you just hit on one thing that I think is very apparent now, especially with analytics and the influence of the three-point line. You just mentioned it, Coach, that it's almost a lost art form. And you could see Michael Jordan doing it a lot, catching the ball in the medium post, 8 feet out, 10 feet out, and just going to work because, as you said, the illegal defense, you couldn't – you either had to double or you had to stay. You couldn't sort of be in between. And now we just don't see guys do that. But and so the artistic part of that game I miss a lot because it's considered – sort of a, you know, a low percentage way to go about it now.
Yeah, and I just think, again, analytics play a huge part in it. And now you would live with that. You would live with Michael Jordan taking a contested mid-range two, and then you come in and try to get more bang for your buck by, you know, getting threes. So it's like over time you feel like you will win out. And there's still outliers, man. There's guys that are really good in the mid-range, and you encourage those. But I think when you look at it as a whole and look at the numbers as a whole, that there's just, you know, it's, you get more bang for your buck by instead of taking that one step in by shot faking and sidestepping, or even get another higher percentage by getting all the way to the basket and possibly getting fouled or getting a layup. So it's, you know, but again, if there's guys that do it at a, you know, unbelievable clip that are outliers, you still encourage. But if not, then let's play to the numbers and get a little bit more bang for a buck.
You have a unique perspective on Michael Jordan. You grew up in North Carolina. You played for the Tar Heels, and then you go into the NBA and you've played against Michael Jordan. How did Michael Jordan influence your life, either directly or indirectly, throughout your development?
Well, I just think we all wanted to be Michael Jordan in some form, you know, just from being an athlete and how he was so, you know, graceful and, you know, just athletic, you know, going to the rim, everything that he did, you know, like, you know, I just, somebody posted something yesterday with me in the McDonald's game, you know, in the McDonald's slam dunk contest, and I got on a gold chain. I got on a gold chain because Michael Jordan had a gold chain in the slam dunk contest. And, you know, so just all those steps that I got an earring when I was in high school, and my mom thought she was going to lose her mind about the earring. And then all I had to say, Michael Jordan got an earring, and then all of a sudden it was okay. So it's like, you know, he influenced us in so many ways. But again, just, you know, getting there and competing, it was a, you know, kind of a different time. As I was coming into the league, he was just kind of coming back. You know, he took off some time and was coming back. So so it was like, man, it took him a little while to kind of get himself back together that first year when they lost to Orlando. And then he was back to being who he was, and we were still all kind of in awe of him, even though we were playing against them and, you know, and that Bulls team. It was like, we're playing them, but we're really not going to beat them. And I think that was kind of the mindset. It was a little bit different when he came back after going and playing baseball. It felt like we were a little bit closer, but obviously we were still a step or two away. And I think, you know, obviously I was with him for a year in Washington, and I think that's where a lot of our guys that came in the early 90s felt like we had finally caught up. You know, we seen Michael to where we could really look at him eye to eye and feel like, okay, we can actually beat him now.
How was he as a teammate for you, especially with all that background, your North Carolina connection and stuff? There's a lot of dynamic in that Last Dance about what he was like to be a teammate with. So what was your experience like?
Well, my experience with him was different because, again, I'm an alpha male myself. So, we, you know, we tap danced around each other, honestly, a lot, you know, just to – because, again, you saw some of the stuff that you saw in the – and stuff like that, and, how he talked to certain of his teammates, that wouldn't have went too well with me. But, you know, we knew that, you know, and he – we've already had tremendous respect for him, and obviously, like I said, from those years, and then – getting to see him at the end of career when he, you know, battling injuries and wasn't really, you know, who we had known him to be. It was just something that, you know, and I've been on record to say it's just something that I could have done without. You know, me coming from Detroit and we're, you know, making it to the second round of the playoffs, and then all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, and I know why I was traded to Washington. I mean, he wanted to go out with a bang. He wanted someone else to ride with him, but it was just, it's hard when you've always been the man and is the greatest of all time in my mind, to, you know, ever relinquish that role of being that guy on the team. And I just felt like at that particular time that I was better suited to carry our team. And I think a lot of our, you know, our team felt that way, but it was just, it's Michael Jordan, you know, so you just kind of go about your business and wait till it's over.
We're talking to Vanderbilt basketball coach Jerry Stackhouse here on Darren, Donick, and Chase. And you also played against Scottie Pippen, who was featured a lot in The Last Dance, and now his son plays for you at Vanderbilt. A young talent, young guy that's still growing into his own. But what was it like of knowing that he's coming into your program and you're trying to develop him as a player, but he also has that pressure, I guess, of how much of a great career his dad had? How were you able to coach that and help him through some of that?
Well, I mean, Scotty's really talented. Scotty Jr. is really talented, man. He just has an understanding of the game, you know, similar to like his dad. His dad was really a point guard. So, I mean, I think, you know, just being able to grow up with, you know, that type of, you know, figure and a guy and having his, you know, understanding and mindset toward the game, you know, I handed him the ball from day one. And it was like, there was really no doubt because, like, when we really took over here, we didn't know. You know, had some guys that jumped in the transfer portal. We had some guys that had, you know, one guy that committed and then, you know, decided he wasn't coming. So, you know, but that was never the case. Scotty has always been a big fan of mine. You know, he was, you know, even when he was doing some ESPN, he was always touting me for, you know, jobs at the NBA. He had watched me work. So when I had an opportunity to coach his kid, it was like a no-brainer. You know, man, we're coming. And I think he's, you know, we're excited about his potential, man, and what he could do. I'm hoping that he gets those 5 inches that Scotty got between his freshman and sophomore year.
Yeah, how's that coming? Has he got any inches? He's got a half inch or two since the season ended?
Hey, man, I just want to be pleasantly surprised. I'm not even going to. I'm not even going to. Nah. But if he gets that, man, you watch out because, again, he can – I mean, he shoots it, he scores it, he's unselfish. I mean, he understands what we're doing on defensive end. He understands what we want to get done offensively. So I'm excited to coach him, you know, hopefully catch those 5 inches, you know, between his junior and sophomore year. Cause I think if he catches him right now, he might not be here too much longer.
We had the opportunity to talk to you after the first SEC win. And that obviously was a big thing to check off the list as you try and build this program, you know, back and build it in your image. So since that time, there were some other wins as well. How did you feel, though, at the end of your first season, looking at the progress that you all made from the beginning to the end?
Well, man, again, it just goes back to other lessons that I learned earlier in the year. I mean, early in my life, like I said, back in North Carolina, like the same thing, just different. Like, we just was dealt with some adversity when Cleavon, you know, went down. And then when Aaron went down, you know, it was just like, okay, now we got to, you know, revamp and try to reinvent who we are on the fly in the middle of SEC play. So, I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of those kids, they could have easily like wrote it off, man. Our best big man and our best player is gone. You know, woe is me. But no, they just continue to work and we continue to kind of observe them as a team and find out things that we could do. And they just, I mean, they played hard, man. They played their butts off every night. And I always would say, man, I've never seen it happen to where when you come in with the right approach and you come in and do the right things, that something good doesn't happen for you at some point during the season. And it did. We had a nice uptick toward the end of the season going into the SEC tournament, you know, just, you know, figuring out who we are. And it was good for those guys. I mean, we had guys that had flashes and had moments all year, but they really started to put it together there. So, you know, we were disappointed that we weren't able to just kind of transition right into the summer and keep that work going and, you know, take advantage of that uptick that we finished on. But, you know, we'll be back at some point, and hopefully we'll be able to continue it, you know, once we're all back together again.
Let's end with this. You just brought up the SEC tournament. You guys were the last game, right? You were the second game in the nightcap?
Yeah, we were the last
game.
Yep.
You were literally the last game in the SEC. So that you were the last game played this college basketball season in the conference. How weird was it, especially at halftime? I think they had made the announcement that they were not going to have fans in the stands the following day. And, of course, we know that the following day would never take place. But how weird was that game that night? Or was it?
Well, I mean, I just, you know, thinking back on it, I wish they could have done that 24 hours before. That'd be one less loss on the record. But
that was an honest answer.
You know what I'm saying? Nah, but, man, it was just an eerie time, man. Like I said, it's unprecedented. We haven't, you know, dealt with any of a pandemic before. Hadn't dealt with, you know, it was kind of scary. And, you know, the kids really weren't in it. You know, I think, you know, just, you know, we did some good things in that game or just wasn't making shots. I don't know if it was guys were, you know, 1 foot on the court and 1 foot, you know, trying to get home. And as soon as that, you know, they canceled it, it was just everything happened so abruptly where, you know, we were trying to get everybody home, get everybody safe. You know, so it was just just a tough situation, you know, during those times, man. But again, you know, I was just glad that we were able to keep everybody safe, and the guys finished up strong. I mean, even with all the distractions of having to go home and have classes online and do all those things, I mean, we still finished with like a 3-5 for the year, man. So really proud of them being able to, again, work through that adversity and finish up strong. So that's good on all fronts.
Jerry, thanks for the time, as always. It's always good to catch up with you. You continue to be safe, and we'll certainly talk to you down the road, and hopefully we'll be talking about your team hitting the court this year. So thanks for doing this.
Man, we're excited. We're excited about it. Can't wait to get them back, man. You guys stay safe as well.
All right. Thank you very much, coach. That is Jerry Stackhouse, Vanderbilt basketball coach. Good conversation with him. We'll come back. More of Darren, Donick, and Chase next on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Thank you, Pete. Don't forget, uniform drawing contest. Hold on.
Dude, Marquise is on point again.
New edition.
Yeah. There you go. A little Cool It Now. The repaired cassette tape from Jerry Stackhouse.
Hopefully he's listening.
Very well done, Marquise.
Wasn't that fun? That was a great interview, Jerry Stackhouse.
Oh, that was really
good. That was awesome.
He just told us that was his jam, and that's the one that he had to keep taping up. We all had to do that. One, we all had to, when it would get all crinkled up, straighten it out, get the pencil out or something, and twist and rewind it, get it back in there, okay, get it back in the cassette, and also, we've all had it where we played it so much that, you know, we had to do a little bit of adjustments. We had to do some fixing up. I mean, we had reel-to-reel. These guys will never remember reel-to-reel in this business. Carts and reel-to-reel is something that was
– I had to learn about it, though.
Very prominent in our business that obviously is way, way, way outdated. But, you know, reel-to-reel, that's how you edit it. Just think about all the editing – Chase, Marquise, that you guys do in this business. Could you imagine if the editing, you had to listen to reel-to-reel and stop it, mark the spot, cut, splice, tape it back together, and that was your edit. That's how you took out something.
Yeah, I know one thing, and from my days as a producer and working with certain people that would ask for a clip or something last minute, that would not be happening.
No, you couldn't do that.
Nope.
That would not be happening with reel-to-reel. But at MTSU, one of my first broadcasting classes that I took, that I was required to take, they taught us reel-to-reel and showed us, and the professor brought in examples and actually did it. And for extra credit, if we edited a piece of audio with reel-to-reel, we got extra credit. So I did.
I did the same thing. I didn't mind it. Didn't love it, but I didn't mind it. Carts were a little bit easier. You were you stuck it on that machine and you erased it by just moving it around. I guess it was like magnetic strip, right? And
yeah,
it just like erased
that.
It. Yeah.
It's been crazy. A long time since I did that.
That's something. I don't think that was necessarily 80s. That was probably more 90s true. I mean, I guess it was. It was definitely 80s. But I guess it started, fading in the 90s. I think that's when probably reel-to-reel and carts and all that stuff kind of went by the wayside.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I'm trying to find it. Somebody texted us and said that kids don't remember fighting with family members to record shows on your VHS and figuring out the pecking order for who got their show recorded over first.
That's great. And, oh, by the way, he just said a key word. You would tape over that. So when you were done, then you could tape things over that. And we all made that mistake, right? Where
over something.
Did you tape it on this one? Oh, no, that's what had my – I had so-and-so on that. You just taped over it. You just recorded over it.
That's a bad feeling. That's a bad feeling.
That's a good one right there. Let's go to Joe. Joe's – I guess he wants to weigh in. Joe, what's up?
Hey, gentlemen, great topic. I mean, I'm in my early 50s, so all this stuff's really hitting close to home. I just wanted to give a quick example of something on the other end of the spectrum. I'm sure many of your listeners my age will totally agree. which was much easier and better in the 80s than it is today, and that's changing a flat tire. My first car was a Buick LeSabre with a crank jack, and that was a 6,000-pound car, and you could have that whole tire changed in about 6 minutes. I look at these little jacks that they put in these cars now, the little black things there with that stupid little bar you got to put in it and try to crank it around and this and that. It's like, you know, I don't even think most people know even how to change a flat tire these days, let alone have the proper equipment to do it. So of all the great technology advances and everything we've come over the years, man, nobody can even change a flat tire anymore because they've just made it so difficult without the equipment to get the job done. As always, guys, thanks so much for taking the call. Great show. Love the show. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you, Joe. You too. That's a good question. Can any of us change a tire? Honest. Honest answer.
I know
yes.
the concept and how, I mean, I know what is supposed to happen and what you're supposed to do.
Have
and
you
I feel
ever
like I
changed
can do
one?
It.
Have you ever changed a flat tire?
I had help.
So you had help. So you've never done it on your own?
No.
Well,
I've done it on my own, but I've done it a couple times, but it wasn't pretty.
What does that mean? It wasn't pretty. What does that mean?
It took me a lot. It took me a lot longer than it should have. You know, just trying to.
But you
get
did it correctly.
Set up the right way, and
like the wheel didn't fall off, right?
I would be nervous.
Well, I mean, the thing is, when you put your spare tire on, it's only going to be there for.
You need to get it straight to the shop.
Well, you got to take it in there anyway.
Yes.
So you're just trying to get it to a shop in most cases there. But I was pretty proud of myself. I'll tell you when it happened. I got a flat tire tire the day of my high school graduation. Going to the morning, it was not going to the actual ceremony. It was like there was like a morning, I don't know, maybe a rehearsal or something. And sure enough, boom. So that was a test. High school.
In high school.
Yeah. The biggest problem for me was not always having all of the tools. I blew out a tire. I was coming back from St. Louis in college to Nashville, and very late at night blew out a tire, and I didn't have a jack in my car, so I was screwed. And fortunately, I was only a few miles from my college roommate, Dan Hall, who lives, and still to this day, he's from Barry Goheen's hometown, to Marshall County, Kentucky, Benton, I think it was the name of his town, tiny town in Kentucky. It just so happened that I was only a few miles from his house, so a guy was nice enough. This is, again, how times have changed, right? No cell phone, late at night, what are you going to do? I was ready to, I was ready to say, what do I do? I knew I was close to Dan's house, but I knew I had to get to a phone.
A pay phone.
Right, so how do I get to a phone? Mm-hmm. So I'm not near an exit, so a guy was nice enough to pull over and offer to help. And he noticed he got the tire changed because he had a jack. And so complete stranger, right? So I'm forever appreciative of him. So I got to the exit, and I called Dan, and it was nice. The little night his dad answered, who played for Vanderbilt way back in the day, and he was like, okay, come on over. It's like probably 1 o'clock in the morning. Didn't exactly expect to hear from me in that particular night.
Did either one of you guys
totally random thing?
Were either one of you guys that guy on a car phone that George always went to? Did you ever have a car phone, or did you just get a
you
cell
talking
phone?
About an no. actual car phone? That's yes. a good one. Like you guys will never remember an
with a cord.
Actual car phone. Not like
see you
not
say
something,
that, but I do.
Like, do you really reading? Like
yes.
mounted in your car?
Yes. Yes,
I'm so, like. How do you? Obviously, that's
my
your,
grandfather had one.
Okay, I was gonna say it had
my dad
a
had one for a while.
Yeah,
really.
And I also
my stepdad did. He definitely had the one mounted. He had one of those like luxury vans. You know what I'm talking about? Like the extended roof, and you know you don't really see them anymore. I guess not as the old school van, 80s. 90s, yeah. You know, the luxury van. He had one of those. He traveled a lot. So he drove, traveled a lot driving, and so he had a mounted phone in, like, the center console of his van in between the driver's side and the passenger side.
I mean, some of this stuff isn't that old. I was born in 1987, so, I mean, the early 90s, I remember some of these things. But also, not only did my grandfather have one, but my friend Logan, his stepdad, Wahoo – that you guys know, Wahoo would call into the show. I was in the car with him a couple of times when he called in, and I would hear George go, let's go to Wahoo on a car phone.
Well, I think George still says on a car phone.
He does.
I think.
He does. It's very true. But, yes, so I am familiar with the car phone.
But I'm surprised because they really started to fade. I would say they were gone by close to mid-90s. They were kind of.
Yeah.
Because cell phones were.
I remember the big gray, you know, brick cell phones. My dad had one of those, but then I even remember the early flip phones, you know, when those things, and those were ginormous, you know, when those came out.
Yep. Let's go to Ben. Ben wants to weigh in. What's up?
Hey, fellas. I've got something on the cassettes. Back years ago, you could buy a cassette to record on, and if you didn't have one that you could record on, then you could take a little piece of paper and put it in the hole or the edge of the, on one end of the cassette, plug it in, and you could record that way.
Ben, you are absolutely right. It was actually up top, right? You would put the tape over up top. Wasn't it both holes? Wasn't it one on the left side and one on the right side, or was it just one?
No, it was just the one you had. I think just the one on the right side.
Okay.
Done that many a day.
Yo, so. Yeah.
Oh, that's all I got, fellas.
That's a great one. Look, if you didn't have the cassette, the empty cassette to record, and you had maybe a tape you didn't really love, right, that you really never listened to anymore, you could just put the tape up top, as he's talking about, over that hole, and he said it's on the right side. I can't remember. We'll just go with what Ben said. On the right side, you put it over there, and then it became a cassette that you could record on. I did that many times, probably because we didn't have money to have both.
Hey, you have to improvise.
You have to improvise as a kid.
Yeah, a lot of recycled tapes, for sure. A
lot of recycled tapes. That's actually a really good one. I had forgot about
that. Is a good one. My brother would do that. He would grab some old tapes, sometimes even a cassette that was like a real tape, you know, not a blank tape to start with, but a real tape that was like somebody's album that he knew I hadn't been listening to. And, you know, like I went off to college, I came back and some tapes that didn't make the cut. In other words, I didn't take him to college with me. He had put the tape over it and taped over it. I was like, what'd you do to you know, who's he, what's it there? He's like, well, you never listen to that anymore. I just taped over my own stuff on there. I was like, what? You don't do that. That's somebody's album. That's my tape, man. You don't do that.
That's good. All right, we will come back and wrap up the third hour of Darren, Donick, and Chase next. Hey, if you own or manage a small business, you're open, you want to let people know about it? Free Business Friday, as we sit here on this Wednesday afternoon, where we're going to give you a chance to advertise for free. Yeah, it's for local businesses that are safely open and working. That's no cost, no catch to you. Go visit thegamenashville.com/FBF for more information. That's thegamenashville.com/FBF, which is, of course, Free Business Friday. For more information, this is a way of supporting small businesses. As we get through this together, it's been a huge success the last three Fridays, and we're looking forward to it again this Friday. So if you haven't taken part in it, you ought to, because it's a really cool concept, and it's an opportunity for you to let people know that you are back open and what your business is about. MTSU, I brought this up yesterday or Monday on the show that Chris Massaro, the AD at MTSU, and Rick Stockstill, the football coach, would be doing kind of a public Zoom session, kind of a webinar for the public, which is pretty interesting. And it was at noon today, and I know you guys had Chip Walters on in the rundown in the 9 o'clock hour, you and Ryan Porth. And I know I've been seeing some quotes while we've been on the air. And one of them that stood out was Chris Massaro said there will be the big part of the plan is for student athletes to be, you know, tested when they return to campus. So that is something, you know, obviously a lot of things being tossed around right now as well. We inch a little bit closer, guys. We're not far. June is literally just around the corner. So it's time to, you know, have all these conversations, and they've been having these conversations. And I feel like on a daily, this week especially, we've seen on a daily basis, we've seen a lot of either conference commissioners or ADs coming out and kind of making statements about this fall season.
Right. It's all going to be tied, I think, to how often will you be able to test your players at a certain point, at least, you know, to some degree. You may not have the full-on test, but there's going to be a routine, I would think, for every practice, and especially any game, where you go in, you get tested, and then you go play, right? That's got to be part almost of the routine. And can we practically do that by that time? That's probably a big part of the equation, because you're just trying, you know, you can't eliminate the risk, right? You know that somewhere along the line on one of these campuses or in one of these pro sports, somebody is going to test positive, somebody's going to get the virus. It's what happens with that, and how can you make sure you minimize that, right? It doesn't spread throughout the entire team or the entire league. You know, that's what you have to avoid. So living with the virus, minimizing risk, and knowing what to do if and when somebody tests positive. But you got to have that mechanism in there, and that's where we're still working on that, right? That's where we've got to come in the next weeks and months.
Well, did you guys see the story today that Redskins rookie wide receiver Antonio Gandy-Golden tested positive on March 24th? So he's a receiver coming out of Liberty. This was obviously before the draft, but this came out today, and he tweeted, "During my pre-draft training, I tested positive for COVID-19 on March 24th. My symptoms, thankfully, were mild, but I self-quarantined for 2 weeks and followed all guidelines from health experts. I was fully cleared April 7th. I feel 100% and can't wait to get on the field for the Redskins ASAP." But that, you know, we've seen NFL players, obviously Von Miller was one of those that came out and said that he, you know, had tested positive for it. But Gandy-Golden, wide receiver Antonio Gandy-Golden, that came out today. So I thought that was interesting in tying that into this conversation.
Well, and that's another thing that we're all wondering is players who fall into that category, and people in general who have been fortunate enough to get through it, right, if they got it, but are they in almost a better position in some ways going forward because we don't know for sure that you could get it again or can't get it again, but you would think that your immune system is in better shape. These are all questions that that we're wondering the answers to, right? Are you better off having had it already, if you can get through it? I mean, obviously, if you get it, there's a risk that it really affects you adversely or puts you in a really terrible situation, but you're relatively lower risk if you're a professional athlete, right, and you don't have any underlying health conditions.
No doubt, but it does look like, at least today, that all signs are pointing towards, you know, they're definitely going to try to do, you know, a fall season. A fall college football season, right?
It would appear that way.
And what was discussed a lot this morning, I saw a couple of people that have been on our show here recently. Paul Feinbaum was one of them, and Laura Rutledge was the other. Jim Harbaugh was a guest on Get Up, and there was discussion about just the possibility that, there might be some college games that are played with no fans in the stands, even though a lot of people early on were adamant. Laura Rutledge's point is some of that belief that it's got to be all or nothing has shifted some with a lot of the feedback that she's gotten over the last few weeks, that maybe they are coming around to a possibility that you could play the games even though you wouldn't have people in the stands.
He did. In fact, it's weird considering where they play that he pretty much said he was fine with it, right? That's quite they have quite the home advantage considering the big house.
Right. But remember, and Darren, you brought this up several times. I can remember there was a lot of sentiment early on that, hey, if the students aren't allowed to come to the games, then how can you put the players out there because the players are students? Right, but it seems like there's been some evolution of thinking there, and it might be tied to how you go about the protocol of testing the players going out there each time.
His quote was, "Heck yeah, I'd be comfortable coaching a game without any fans. if the choice were to play in front of no fans or not play, then I would choose to play in front of no fans. And, you know, I think that, to me, that kind of goes without saying. He said, I've talked to
our team. I
think
a lot of people feel that way.
That's the way they feel. Oh, he just said, I've talked to our team. That's the way they feel about it. He says, darn near every guy.
I don't think that's surprising.
No. No, that's not really any earth-shattering news.
No, I think most people would answer it that way. But, Darren, going back to the point that you brought up a number of times, will that work in the context of the whole environment on campus? Right? There's a lot of campuses saying, okay, we're gonna have our courses at first are going to stay online. You know, the other people are saying, no, we're going to have students. We're going to have the classes. We're going to go with it. And so the whole, if it's not safe enough to have the students in the stands, then how can it be safe enough for the players to play because the players are students? It does look like there's going to continue to have some evolution of the thinking there.
No doubt. I still think it's going to be hard to – how do you have students back on campus and in classes, but yet they're not allowed to go to a football game? Like that to me
–
doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, whether you allow, you know, season ticket holders or just anybody who's in the general public to come, that's one thing. But how do you have students back on campus and in classes and paying full tuition, but yet it's not safe to go to a football game? Like that to me doesn't make any sense.
But are students the first fans that are back in an event because of what you just said? If they go, okay, you know what? They're on class, they're around they're on campus, they're in class, they're around each other. That makes sense. So let's open the doors and allow them to come to the games. Is that how we start having fans back at sporting events if it's students? Now, you're going to have people pushing back going, that's a horrible idea. But to your point that you just made, if it's safe to be on campus and in class, then why isn't it safe to go to a game? So that's a very interesting point. I wonder if that opens the door to having fans back at events. And then, of course, you're going to have season ticket holders at some of these universities that are going to be complaining and saying, well, if they can, if it's safe for them, why isn't it safe for me? But I am curious on that.
I don't know how
that
you
answer that.
It could
be the can
that.
Of worms.
How do you answer, how is it safe to be on campus and in class and paying full tuition, but it's not safe to be at the football game?
It's complicated.
I don't think there's a good answer. I mean, it's
right.
It's the same thing.
Well, are the students being tested as they go into the game? That would be one of the things. Maybe if you had a way.
Well,
that
what
they
if they're already
are they
tested
getting tested
going in,
to go into class?
Fine.
Well,
yeah.
How are they going to class?
That's a good question.
I mean, you can't. So, what's the protocol for going to class?
That's what we have to find out.
I think
out.
You have to be tested, don't you?
We're all coming back. We're coming back to the same thing, no matter where the discussion goes, and that is how far can testing come between now and when you've got to make these decisions, right? July, August, et cetera.
Right. No doubt. All right, that'll do it for hour number three of Darren Donick and Chase. When we come back, Chris Mason, our weekly chat with him. That's next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21+.
Moto Casino.